First, the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration enforcement policy led to more than 2,000 children being separated from their parents before the practice was officially rolled back last June. But a report last month from the Department of Health and Human Services says that thousands more families may have been separated than it first acknowledged. It says that getting an accurate count was effectively impossible due to many children being released from custody to live with sponsors in the U.S. and for parents looking to reunite with their children while their own cases are processed, navigating the legal system can be a challenge. Aaron Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW-Madison Law School. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you talk about what we learned in this report from the Department of Health and Human Services?
What we learned was we didn't receive many facts about what any additional information. So the report basically said that there were thousands more than originally reported of children that were separated by our government. But our government can't track them because they didn't have a proper way of tracking them. And the separation of children also occurred much earlier than we learned after zero tolerance was announced.
And it sounds like in some cases, Health and Human Services didn't know if a kid had been separated from their family versus a kid had arrived at the border on their own. That information wasn't necessarily provided to them from the Department of Homeland Security?
Correct. So when a child or a family or an individual arrives at the border and is trying to seek asylum or entry into the United States, they will get categorized in a certain with a certain number, a certain an A number, or in a category as part of a family unit, or an unaccompanied child. So an unaccompanied child is someone who comes without a parent. But when they started doing this, they had no way of tracking or giving an individual a number as a child who was separated, because that just wasn't part of our system. And so through that, they would take a picture of the parent and the child, and that was the only way that they were tracking these children.
What do we know from this Department of Health and Human Services statement saying there were thousands more kids? What do we know about where those children ended up?
We know very little. We know that there are still children in detention facilities or child care facilities that have been separated. But we also know that a lot of them were released to family members or to guardians in the United States. But the government hasn't tracked them, which gives us a lot of people who are advocates fears of where these children are.
Can you talk about the policies in place for where to assign children from Health and Human Services? You mentioned it could be relatives, it could be other guardians, and there's kind of a hierarchy of how they're supposed to be assigned.
Sure. So they're looking for someone who is a family member. So a parent is obviously going to be the first choice. Sometimes that parent in these situations isn't an option because that parent has been deported. A lot of the parents that came and were separated from their children were deported back to their home country. And the parents had the choice of leaving alone or giving their child the opportunity to remain in the United States to apply for asylum. So sometimes that happens.
And you've worked we've talked to you in the past about working with people at the border trying to navigate the legal system there. Can you talk about painful decision, whether to be deported with your child or to leave them here in the United States? What are they weighing when it comes to the idea of should I take my kid back home to the situation that made me flee in the first place?
Right. So I think the most difficult part of it is the information that these parents were given. A lot of them didn't understand because they were in traumatic situations where their child was just ripped from their arms. We're representing a few families who have children who have been permanently separated from their parents, and also families that have been reunited. And the trauma that they have already incurred is unbelievable. They couldn't, when the parents were presented themselves for what's called a credible fear interview, they had already been separated from their children. So when an officer said, "Why are you scared to return to your home country?" they couldn't speak in certain situations because all they wanted to know was where their child was, a child as young as 5.
We're talking to Aaron Barbato from the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW-Madison Law School about child separation at the U.S.-Mexico border. A new report says thousands more families were separated than previously reported. Aaron, for a parent now who came, tried to claim asylum, didn't get that, was deported, and their kid was separated, ended up with someone in the United States, what recourse do they have? What kind of channels are out there for them to try to find their children?
There's a few settlements one settlement that's going on where families organizations are trying to find parents of children that were permanently separated from their children. But it's incredibly difficult because a lot of these parents have returned to the countries where there's a lot of danger and there's no way for them to communicate, or they live in very rural areas where they don't have access to legal counsel or even to the internet. So it becomes almost impossible to do that. In one of our cases where the parent didn't pass her credible fear interview because she couldn't speak because she had been separated from her 5-year-old daughter for 6 weeks without any knowledge of where she is, the government is allowing her to present her credible fear interview one more time, and we will be representing her through that process.
And this credible fear interview, that is, that's for the asylum process, right? Saying that there's a credible fear of serious harm if they were sent back home.
Right. If they pass their credible fear interview, then they're allowed to process for asylum within the United States.
But that's not a guarantee that they would get asylum.
Absolutely not. No.
What is the process for someone seeking asylum if they enter through a port of entry or through another point along the border? What are the steps to get from there to asylum?
So there are a number of steps, and it depends on whether you enter the United States at a port of entry. And it's gotten more complicated now because of the new migrant protections protocol or the Remain in Mexico process. So there's many different ways to do it. If you enter the United States with authorization, you can apply for asylum here in the United States. If you enter at the southern border or even in Canada without authorization, you will most likely be detained, need to pass your credible fear interview, and then hopefully will be released if you're a family to apply. A lot of people are also detained through the entire process. So it's really complicated depending on where you're at and what your background is.
And at various points in the last couple of years, we've heard of a backlog in processing these claims of asylum. Where are we on that now?
You know, it depends on where you are in terms of how long the asylum process can take. So for individuals, for example, who are detained in Dodge County Correctional Facility, those process within 4 to 6 months because they're in detention. But those who are not in detention, it can take a year or two to get your final hearing to apply for asylum in front of an immigration judge.
Now, getting back to child separation, can you talk about the history of how we got here? Because there was... it's been called a child separation policy. The Trump administration denied it was a policy. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the steps that led to this larger scale child separation than we'd seen previously?
And a lot of that is unclear of how, because we're just learning that they really started, there was a spike in separation of parents and children in October of 2017. And we didn't learn about this until much later in April of 2018. But it is a policy. It's not a law that we have to separate children and their parents, except when we've had policies in the past when there's a danger to the child. So if the child is being trafficked or the parent has a very serious criminal conviction, but it's still very unclear what our government is doing because they're still separating children from their parents based on those risk factors for the child. But we have very little knowledge of what those risk factors are and what they're using to weigh those.
Right. The Trump administration had argued that some people were bringing in children that weren't their children as kind of a shield, a way to get it to game the system. Do we know if that happened and how common it was?
We don't know how common it is, but I know that it has happened. But in certain situations, it's because the parent was murdered or the child has no one else to protect them. So an aunt is going to take them in. That's what families do. Children need protection. Children are precious. So other people than their parents are also going to try to help them.
We're talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School, about the prospect of reunifying families separated at the southern border and recent reports that many more families were separated than previously reported. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how the legal system works for people apprehended crossing the border seeking asylum? Do you think the government should be doing more to reunite parents and children? What action would you like to see? How do you assess the results looking back of last year's so-called zero tolerance immigration policy at the border? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School. We're looking at the status of immigrant families separated under the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy that ended last summer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how the legal system works for immigrants who are separated from their children? Do you think the government has done enough to try to make sure those families get reunited? What changes would you like to see? Looking back on this story, how do you view last year's zero tolerance policy and its aftermath? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Aaron, as you mentioned, some children are still being separated from their families at the border if there is a perceived risk to the children. Is there a better system in place for tracking these kids and who they came in with and the possibility of reuniting when appropriate?
So what we know now from a federal judge who ordered the reunification of the children last summer, they also required our government to have a tracking system for the children. And so at this point, we're hoping that the children are being able to be tracked if they are separated from their parent. But if they're being separated from their parent at this point, it should be because reunification is impossible due to a danger. So reunification may not be possible in the future, but hopefully we'll be able to track them in a better way.
And I think it was the same judge who had set deadlines for reunifying families. How did we do on that? Or have we reunified all the children involved at that point?
You know, at this point, there are still a number of children that have not been reunified, and the government is saying that it's because reunification is impossible. And it was kind of what we discussed before in terms of the danger to the child, or they can't find the parent because the parent has been deported and they're just not able to find them.
Now, as compared to when this all started, what is the policy when families come across the border seeking asylum?
So families coming across the border seeking asylum, right now, they should be allowed to remain as a family unit. But that doesn't mean that they're released into the general public to apply for asylum. They're still detained. It is still family detention, and children are still being detained in these facilities that are very questionable in the way that they treat the people that are living there.
Are there efforts to who runs these now? Is it Health and Human Services or is it Homeland Security? Who is in charge of those?
So the family detention facilities are run by Immigration Customs Enforcement, by ICE. A child who's alone is going to be placed with the Office of Refugee Resettlement. So it's different.
And you mentioned, and we've talked about this on the show before, there are some people detained here in Wisconsin at, I think you said, the Dodge County Jail?
Yeah, there's two detention facilities here in Wisconsin. One is in Dodge County and one is in Kenosha. But these are not family. Mm. These are only individuals without children in those facilities.
Now, what kind of legal help is available for people in these various situations? What kind of access do they have to legal counsel, if any?
I mean, the bottom line is people who are facing deportation have very little access to legal counsel, regardless of where they are in the country, much less at the border where we're detaining so many people. But also here in Wisconsin, there's just not very many resources to people who are facing deportation. And our government provides no legal paid representation for people who are facing deportation.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Green Bay. Sarah, hello.
Hi there. I'm just calling because I actually am a bilingual teacher in Green Bay, and I've been really bothered about what's been going on at the detention centers with youth along the border, and I've been looking into doing some potential like temporary housing or some fostering for teens at the border, and have been coming up short. And I don't know if you know if there's any resources for Wisconsinites to help out, even though we're so far from the border.
Sarah, thank you so much for your question and for your kindness and thought for all these children who are in need of help. I don't know at this point whether Wisconsin is, they haven't in the past been fostering any children that have been separated, but I can look into that for you and become a resource if that becomes available.
Thanks for the call, Sarah. And I guess theoretically for children who they can't find a family member in the country to go with, they would at least, I imagine, look for foster parents closer to the border?
Yes, all over the country. People have been placed from the border in Michigan. I know there have been foster children taken into foster care in Michigan, but I don't know of any in Wisconsin at this point.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School, looking at the latest news on family separation and reunification at the U.S.-Mexico border. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Now, Aaron, last time we talked about your trip to Texas, I think it was, with law students trying to provide representation to people going through this asylum process. Remind us of some of the stories you heard.
So most of the women that we were at the South Texas Family Residential Facility, where they house over 2,000 women and children. These are all women and children, most of them fleeing violence and gangs in the Northern Triangle of Central America. So these women walk many miles with their children to seek refuge here in the United States, to seek safety, to protect their children. Most of them, every woman we talked to had a story to tell regarding their persecution in their home country, mostly due to violence from gangs and from their husbands or family members.
And you are looking at making another trip, I think.
Correct. So I will be heading down to Tijuana to volunteer at the refugee camp there, because now that our government is implementing a policy that was originally named Remain in Mexico, where asylum seekers are forced to stay in Mexico until they have presented their asylum application at the border. So there are long lines and many people waiting there. So I'm heading there to help volunteer and to help people prepare their asylum packets in Tijuana.
Go back to our callers now. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hello.
Yes, hello. I'm enjoying this discussion. Let's talk about this. The last surviving judge from the Nuremberg trials has called the Trump administration's policy of separating children and detaining them crimes against humanity. My question is, what lawsuits now are pending against the Trump administration on these actions?
You know, there are a number of lawsuits pending against these actions. The ACLU is incredibly aware of everything that's going on and is being very thoughtful and aggressive in the actions they're taking. A few weeks ago, they filed a lawsuit on behalf of the women and children that were separated for monetary costs due to what they called inexplicable cruelty by our government against them. There are also lawsuits about the Flores settlement, which should only allow children to be in detention 5 days, but in a time of influx, 20 days. And also the children have clean water, clothing, basic care. And as I mentioned, I think before, where we volunteered in Dili, we weren't allowed to drink the water. So there's a lot of action going on against what's been happening.
Thanks for that call, Martha. We'll go now to Melissa in Antigo. Melissa, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up?
Well, I guess I just had mostly a quick question, and I'm under the impression that a lot of the resources that these refugees from their country of origin, that there have been programs available for them to kind of help them along the way, knowing what to do. And I'm also under the impression under our new administration that some of those programs have dissipated, and I'm curious if that's true or if you have any information on that.
So are there resources, if you're someone in, say, Central America, looking at making this journey, trying to seek asylum, are there resources available in their countries of origin?
You know, I'm not aware of any resources that are available in their country of origin in terms of helping prepare people to make the heroic trek across to the United States. There may be some available, but I'm not really aware of that.
And can people make applications for asylum, say, at a consulate in another country, or do they actually have to come and present themselves at the border?
So if you're outside of the country, what you would be doing is applying for refugee status, mm-hmm. and that has to be done with the United Nations. And the problem is, in Central America, in the Northern Triangle, there are no resources to do that there.
The United Nations might focus on a war zone like
Correct.
Syria, for example.
Exactly.
So what we talked earlier about the backlogs in trying to deal with asylum applications, and then people are either waiting in Mexico or in detention in many cases. Would you like to see more resources put into people to evaluate these decisions, to expedite these requests?
You know, I think there's a need for a number of resources in order to make our immigration system more fair, especially as we're looking at children and we're looking at people who are seeking refuge. They are vulnerable and they deserve protection because that's what our laws allow. In terms of the backlog, it almost seems uncontrollable because now that the government shut down for so many weeks, the backlog even increased substantially. So I'm not sure what the answer is to that.
And getting back to our starting point, the report that there were thousands of more separations than we'd previously known, does the judge's reunification order apply to those kids who were separated from their families before this was in the public eye?
You know, it's a really good question because we're just learning about the information and whether the judge's order from last summer would include something that occurred prior to that decision. It's unclear.
What are you watching for as we wrap up?
I'm watching for our government to start protecting individuals who qualify for asylum, and especially for children. Children deserve a chance to be safe, and that's the only thing that these parents are doing while they're trying to bring them here to the United States.
Erin, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me.
Erin Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW-Madison Law School. She was with us for an update on immigrant families separated at the border and the challenges they face in getting reunited.